Welcome to the Sports Medicine Podcast, brought to you by the Sidney and J.L. Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance in the Department of Health and Kinesiology at Texas A&M University. At the Huffines Institute, we're always working to facilitate, apply, and bring you the most up-to-date coverage of the wide world that is sports medicine and human performance, all in language you can understand and share with your friends. And now, here's our host, the director of the Huffines Institute, Dr. Tim Lightfoot.
Well, hello, and I want to welcome everyone to the Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance weekly podcast. We're so glad that you joined us today. We are so pleased to have Dr. Mindy Millard Stafford with us. Dr. Millard Stafford is a professor and the associate chair of the School of Applied Physiology at Georgia Tech. She originally got her PhD from the University of Georgia, and she has focused her research on the importance of hydration to delay fatigue and maintain safety during exercise in the heat. She's also a past president of the National American College of Sports Medicine. As many of you who have listened know, it's the largest organization of exercise scientists in the country. Welcome to the podcast, Mindy.
Well, thank you very much, Tim. It's a pleasure to be here today.
And we want to start off talking about hydration. You know, it's really hot outside in many parts of the country. Since your expertise is hydration, can you just give our listeners some general guidelines for hydration when you're working outside?
It is one of the things that we probably don't pay as close attention to during our daily lives, except when it is hot and we think about fluids and perhaps that our thirst kicks in, so to speak, to trigger us to focus on our daily fluid needs. But the first thing is that we've been looking at all kinds of folks, whether it's an athlete who obviously through their sweat loss needs more fluid than other folks who are not very active on a daily basis. It's not uncommon to see that from kids to young adults, which is basically most of the folks we have dealt with, we have not done studies on the elderly per se, but it's not uncommon for us to be in a state of sort of chronic dehydration. In fact, we have just completed a study where we looked at free-living young adults during summer months, like we're having in a typical summer in southeast United States in Georgia where it was quite hot. These young folks came in and we had a basic test of urine concentration, their body weight. We did some blood markers, which a little more invasive. And we saw on average probably well over 50% of folk would have been classified as not hydrated on a morning or during the afternoon.
Well, that's interesting. Why wouldn't they have been hydrated? I mean, most of us in the United States anyway have access to fresh, clean water.
Right. That's certainly not the issue, and it's free. We don't have to buy it at a store.
Right.
So what is the reason? I don't know exactly the reason, but first we thought, well, if we bring them in the morning and it's a summer heat wave, maybe that makes sense. They just haven't had the full day to hydrate. But when we had them come back in the afternoon, that number, while it went down some, we still had 45 to 55% of men and women still having a urine concentration that we would classify as moderately dehydrated.
Hmm.
We also then looked at individuals during the winter. Again, just free living, not really doing any kind of exercise intervention, morning, and then again in the afternoon. And do you know that frequency distribution did not change?
Really?
We still had, in the afternoon, over 60% of individuals, this is a sample of about 25 to 30 men and women, about over 60% were still, based on urine concentration, considered moderately, now not severely, but moderately dehydrated.
Hmm. And so there's not a seasonal. It's not that it happened more in the summer than in the winter. You were still seeing it in the winter as well.
Yeah, and that was a real surprise to us.
Well,
because one would think it would make sense. Well, if they're out in the garden all day, or if they're out, you know, walking even around, if it's a college student walking on campus all day, maybe they're just not really paying as much attention in the summer. But no, it had absolutely no influence on the sort of status of chronic hydration of individuals.
Well, you know, and we talked about there's plenty of water available, and certainly there has been the message put out in the media quite often about you need to drink, especially when it's hot outside, quite a bit. But there seems to be some conflicting, recommendations. Some people say drink 8 glasses of water a day. Some say drink when you're thirsty. Some say drink a certain amount that's relative to your body weight. So how much should people be drinking?
Isn't that the really big question? As you alluded to, Tim, you know, should you obey your thirst?
Mm.
Is thirst a good enough, an accurate gauge?
Mm-hmm.
If you look at this data I just talked about, one would suggest that maybe thirst isn't necessarily as accurate on a long-term basis. The other question is, of course, how much is enough fluid? And I don't think we can prescribe an absolute amount.
Mm.
You know, the old 8 glasses of 8 ounces of fluid also doesn't take into fact that if we eat a very healthful diet full of fresh fruits and vegetables, et cetera, we're getting some fluid contributions from those foods. But let me give you an example that I think we found out in our study. We asked in this hydration study for the men and women to drink a fair amount extra and really pay attention to really get extra fluid in. And even when they did that, they really couldn't drink much more than 3 liters a day.
Mm.
And you figure 1 liter is about 32 ounces. That clearly is, you know, more than the 8x8. Now, I'm not saying that people need to drink more than 8x8, but where we get our fluid, it doesn't have to just be plain water. We get it from a lot of other sources.
Well,
that also is a point of confusion in the lay, and for the folks at home.
Well, but you also bring up a good point. So 8 glasses of 8 ounces of water, you say we can get water in other places like fruits and so forth. Would sodas be a good substitute for that water? I mean, so many people drink pop,
right,
as we say in the South, or soda pop or Cokes or whatever you want to call them.
Or sweet tea. Don't forget sweet tea now.
Sweet tea.
Well, what I think we have to realize is that all beverages hydrate and contribute to the water component.
Right.
And that even though water is usually what is identified, that fruit juices and other sources, sports drinks, particularly for athletes who are losing sodium, particularly in their sweat. So all of these do count in the total intake. Now, what does get confusing for folks as well, and you mentioned soft drink, soda, coffee, and I interjected tea, the fact that these often will contain some amounts of caffeine, more, of course, for coffee, lesser amounts usually for tea and for soft drinks, is that, well, what about caffeine? Does it count? Because many times there's confusion about do caffeinated beverages count? And yes, they do. What we've found with our research, particularly with athletes, is that caffeine, if anything, is a very mild diuresis, and you're still getting a lot of that water is retained, particularly during exercise when caffeine does not act as a diuretic. The kidney isn't really processing the fluid to the same extent as during rest.
So this comes back to the idea that maybe that caffeine is actually diuretic, which actually makes you lose fluid as opposed to retaining it. And you're saying that that's not really the case.
That is not the case. Now, I will not say that some people do not have a little bit more fluid loss, but if we drink plain water, that's a stimulant for fluid urine production as well.
Mm-hmm.
Plain water is actually one of the best diuretics. But on average, particularly when people are tolerant and are habitual caffeine users, such as I am, really over long periods of time, at the end of a day, there's not a significant loss of fluid by drinking that cup of coffee in the morning compared to if you replace that with a non-caffeinated beverage.
Okay. Now, you had mentioned some of the research. I know you guys have produced a couple of large reviews in the last couple of years on the role of caffeine, whether or not caffeine actually can, along with a sports drink, can increase in exercise endurance or muscular strength. What were the results of those reviews that you guys did?
Yeah, well, thanks, Tim. They were pretty interesting. Much to our surprise, one of the reviews, and really Dr. Gordon Warren can really take the credit for doing the systematic review of the effect of caffeine on muscular strength and muscular endurance. And we found this after doing one of our sports drink studies in the heat, where after exhaustive exercise, we found that adding caffeine to the sports drink maintained leg strength much better than either water or the sports drink alone. And we thought this was a bit curious. So we replicated and then did that systematic review, and lo and behold, caffeine does seem to have a benefit in muscular strength, particularly in the groups such as the quadriceps or thigh muscles, where it's difficult for individuals to maximally activate all of their thigh muscle. It may not be as effective in some activities that focus on some of the smaller muscle groups of the upper body, for example.
Right.
So the mechanism still remains to be seen, but it was quite clear there was a significant impact and benefit on strength to go along with what was already been well documented by many others in the past, that it improves your endurance as well.
So, Justin, I guess we better start taking in caffeinated beverages.
I think so.
Yeah. Let me follow up. I loop back a little bit on part something you said earlier, and we talked a little bit about following your thirst and only drinking when you're thirsty. Does your perception of thirst change as you get older? I mean, are you less likely to feel thirsty? It seems like I've seen or read some of that literature that one of the reasons that older folks in particular are so much at danger for dehydration is because they don't perceive thirst like younger folks do.
To be honest, as I said earlier, we have not done any of this work with older individuals. That is one of the thoughts, pervading notions out there.
Mm-hmm.
What complicates things a little bit is that also in older individuals, there's usually concern for things like incontinence. Other medications may play a role, perhaps use of diuretics or other things. So there's a lot of behavioral aspects as well where individuals, you know, don't want to have an accident, so maybe how much of that is thirst and how much to tease out the different factors,
right,
that play a role. So that, I think that is where we do need to have additional good data, because the problem with elderly who shut into homes during heat waves, and then, you know, also the importance of hydration status to prevent things like kidney stones and other bladder types of problems. So there's a lot of general health aspects that could be improved with adequate, and again, I want to stress adequate hydration, not overhydration, because even too much of a good thing can be even fatal. In the case of what has been shown to be fatal is water intoxication when far too much fluid is consumed. So we do have to acknowledge the fact that if we overconsume fluids, that and particularly plain water, that's also a risk.
Now, how much do you have to drink to have water intoxication? Gallons or ounces, or how much are we talking about?
I would say we're talking about gallons. And as you probably know, Tim, but maybe not the rest of the audiences, where this has occurred has been in cases, for example, it started first being documented in ultramarathon races where particularly lower body weight, maybe slower back-of-the-pack runners, and often women who try to be very diligent about their fluids, and they well over-consume over a long period of time. Far too much fluid relative to their sweat rate. And if it's very dilute fluids and they're losing some sodium in their sweat, it compounds the issue. That's where it has been documented. And then I think the well-known case of some, and I don't want to go into the details, I don't know all the court case and the legal aspects where there was a radio contest, how much fluid can you drink in one sitting, where, you know, but those are just sort of beyond the normal habits people would partake in.
Yeah. So much of the advertising for the sports drinks that we see really emphasizes the fact that when you drink the sports drinks, you're getting in the electrolytes that you lose when you sweat. Are those electrolytes really key? Are these things that we really have to have? Say if I'm going to go out and mow the yard for 30 minutes, do I need a sports drink when I finish?
I think the best rule of thumb is for the person who is not highly active and not really losing a lot of total fluid, that water could be sufficient for most individuals. And where it becomes important, I think, is if people are overweight to obese, you know, if there's additional calories that aren't needed, because one could easily just salt the food a little more during those periods of hot weather. What is interesting, though, is when individuals go out in the early part of the summer months, they're sweat is much saltier than after they adapt to the heat. So this acclimatization, and that's why it's so hard to prescribe an exact amount, because not only is the sweat content of individuals much different among folks, but then even within the person, their sweat becomes less salty as they either become more fit or more adapted to being outside in the heat.
So physiologically, folks can adapt to the heat.
And their sweat reflects that.
So what they may be able to do at the beginning, they may be able to do more at the end of the summer months than they were at the beginning of the summer months, just because they're used to it.
Yeah, and so the role of a sports drink may be more important earlier in the summer than late.
So drink up early in May and June, right?
Yeah, and I think the other important thing is people can sort of monitor the color of their urine. Monitoring the color of the urine sounds a little gross, but if the urine is bright, bright gold or orange, or even, heaven forbid, into the brown family, then they say, whoa, my urine's too concentrated. It needs to be a very pale yellow, and that's when you're getting it probably keeping hydrated in the right amount.
And that's one of the things they'll look at, especially in some of the ultra races, is at some of the checkpoints. I know I've been involved with some of those where they'll actually look at the color of your urine to make sure you're still hydrated so you can continue to run.
And that's what they've done for wrestlers and other athletes who tend to try to make weight by dehydrating so they can not impair their safety.
Yeah. So while it sounds gross, we would tell our listeners that's a key that you can look for to make sure you're properly hydrated.
Yeah, and their kids and their parents and so forth.
I guess change gears a little bit. I know one of the interesting areas that you have started to get involved with is prosthetics, the exercise performance of folks who wear prosthetic devices. Can you share a little bit of that with us? How'd you get into that? Why'd you get into it? What are some of your interesting findings?
What happened there, a lot of things are always dictated by your students when you're in academia. And at Georgia Tech, we started the very first master's program in the country in prosthetics and orthotics. We started that about 7 years ago. And as a result of that, the master's students, then they go on, and it's a clinical degree. They have to go on and do residency. But as a part of their curriculum as master's students, they need to be involved in a project that's, it's not a full thesis or anything to the extent of a full research paper. Some of these students were interested in looking at the impact of different prosthetic feet. My first doctoral student, Dr. Mary Beth Brown, took the lead on this paper that you're referring to, where she just simply wanted to see what it is about, first of all, could amputee runners attain the same level of aerobic capacity as a matched runner, one who's matched for training and other physiological and and structural characteristics. Then we also wanted to see about some of these new J-legs, these high-tech feet, and how do they allow the runner to perform. And there was this controversial case of the Olympic and Paralympic athlete Oscar Pistorius. He was a double amputee, and there was thought that he was gaining an advantage from these J-blade legs compared to a non-amputee. And so we happened to have some data on another bilateral amputee in our laboratory. His name is Scott Rigsby. He was the first bilateral amputee to finish an Ironman triathlon.
Mm, wow.
And he was local here in Atlanta. And again, my student really helped work with him and in his training, and we evaluated his aerobic fitness periodically on the treadmill. So that's how some of that work, we got into that little sort of sub area. And it's pretty clear that, you know, an amputee is very much limited by the technology of their prosthetic foot.
Right.
If
right.
they get these high-tech legs, which are not cheap, they can achieve similar peak running speeds and very high VO2 maxes as non-amputees. And this, of course, is for those individuals who lose a limb due to trauma, not due to diabetes or other pathology.
Right.
But when our soldiers now go into, there's this Center for the Intrepid down there in Texas, it's pretty clear that their performance can nearly equal that if the right foot technology is used. So that's the good news.
Now you mentioned Oscar Pistorius and his efforts to try to be allowed to compete with able-bodied runners at the Olympic level. And there was quite a bit of controversy. I think there was a group of, 7 to 9 scientists that evaluated these prosthetic legs, and that group split, and actually one part of the group said that he actually had an advantage by wearing those. And so I know it's quite controversial at the international level as to whether or not he should be allowed to run in the Olympic trials.
And I think we'll continue to follow that. Again, we were not directly, I was not directly involved in that, but from a physiological standpoint, there's not a metabolic advantage. But I think the question becomes one of the spring, and I think it was more the biomechanical aspect where the group split.
Right. Yeah.
Did
the legs store energy and return energy better than a normal runner's legs?
Yeah, so that you don't have the same level of fatigue, but it's pretty clear the metabolic cost of being on even a high-tech leg. Those runners still have a higher heart rate, and their metabolic cost is still higher than one who had both legs. So it just depends on the feature, and I think, you know, as we learn more, we understand where things are going. But, definitely still a controversial case, but interesting. And again, I think the good news is that these individuals can enjoy a very highly fit, active life.
Not be limited like they have been in the past.
Exactly.
So the wonderful thing about talking to you is now we get to change directions one more time and talk to you about your work as past president of the American College of Sports Medicine. I know that you've been very involved not only in ACSM but in other avenues to help encourage females to get involved in sports medicine.
I guess I'm dating myself now by talking about timeline, but when colleagues that came ahead of us, the several waves of women in the history of sports medicine, and the college, ACSM, was founded in 1954. I know that was before you were born, Tim, but
barely.
So it wasn't until 1988 that ACSM had our first women president, and that was Dr. Barbara Drinkwater. And reflecting that, you know, things for women, opportunities for women in not only higher education but also in the field of sports science, you know, they weren't as well promoted, and there wasn't a big track record.
Right.
And then we had the second wave of women, I like to refer to it, in the late 90s and through 2001 and 2002, and that was Toby Tate, Priscilla Clarkson, and Angela Smith. And Angela was the first medical doctor in 2001 who served as president for the Merton College. So I was just the fifth coming along in 2008, and the first PhD president who was also a mom. And so I think that what we've seen over time, gradual as it may be, is that women obviously are not only just going into the field
right.
of sports science and sports medicine, but it's taken a bit of time to have us also elevate into the higher levels of leadership and into the higher levels of academia. You know, for all degree-granting universities, at the doctoral level, only 25% of tenured female faculty are getting into these associate and full professors. Yet, well over 60% of all bachelor's degrees, and really, I think even the number of PhDs is approaching 50%. So we just, again, our pipeline is wide open for women to get into the field, but we still aren't elevating as many to higher levels.
Right. Well, I think lest our listeners think that ACSM was an old boys club until 1988. One of the, seven founders of ACSM was Josephine Rathbone, who was a female. Right.
That's right.
Yeah, but your point is very well taken that it took a while for women to be elevated into the leadership role in ACSM. And so for our listeners, what you don't know is what you didn't hear was that during the middle of that conversation, our telephones went dead. We're picking our conversation back up. You're back with us, right, Mindy?
Yes, Tim. Sorry about that.
No need to apologize. Technology is great sometimes. What we were talking about was the role and the of women in ACSM and in leadership and sports medicine institutes. But what we were talking about earlier, Mindy, was that there are at least 50% women now in our undergraduate population. And I've seemed to observe over the years, especially over the last 6 or 7 years, that the large proportion of women in the a large proportion of the graduate students are women as well. So my concern is, what's happening to the men? Where are the men going?
The other thing is, if the programs are growing, Tim,
right.
So if the whole pot is bigger,
yeah,
and so maybe the number of men is the same, absolute number, but is it the percentage? I can't really answer that.
Yeah.
Perhaps they're going into fields that pay more money.
Well, I don't know.
But the other thing is, just to sort of finish that thought, is that fellows who are women, we still only have 10% of the fellows, the leadership of the college, who are women.
Now let's clarify for our listening audience. I'm sorry to interrupt you there, but fellows in this case is a honorary title given to someone who's achieved excellence in sports medicine as determined by the ACSM, and so they're designated as a fellow of the American College of Sports Medicine.
Fellowship, meaning the leadership.
Yeah.
So, you know, the other thing that has, we hope that women will continue to try to do what it takes to go into the profession and stay in the profession, because, you know, life is complicated when we try to have a family, when you have two career couples. The challenges today continue to be what maybe explain the lack of seeing folks sort of push through, particularly in academia, with publish or perish. The tenure promotion process is sometimes competing with biological clocks. There's all kinds of issues that make it challenging for women, but doesn't mean we can't do it, but I hope that we will continue this trend, as you say, that not only women are getting terminal degrees, higher level degrees, but then continue on, no matter if it's later in their lives, which is not uncommon, and not just the traditional time frame that we often think about.
But you are not advocating, because I've known you for many years, I know you're not advocating that women get promoted just because they're women.
Absolutely not.
No, you just want to, and I agree with you, I think that we just want them treated fairly in the tenure and promotion process and all aspects of academia and other leadership forms.
Yeah, you know, Tim, here's something interesting. In sport, we know that women are equal participants, and a lot of that as a result of Title IX back in 1972. But did you realize that in the sport of swimming, which is my passion, the sport I came through, and my daughter now is Olympic trial qualifier, she's actively involved in swimming. Do you know that there's never been a head Olympic coach for swimming that's a woman?
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's not going to happen until next year in London in 2012.
Really?
And the first time, and that's Terry McKeever from Cal Berkeley, and the first time she was on a staff was just in 2004. So I think it just goes to show that it's still important for women still need to aspire to achieve these areas.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think that we could do a whole podcast on the role of gender in sport, and I think we'll have to invite you back and do that. I mean, as we were talking earlier, we did our podcast last week was on the role of race in sport. We might as well attack gender in sport as well, right?
Yeah, and I guess the caveat, get a decent phone next time.
Yeah. Well, we're running out of time here, and so I want to, we always wrap up by giving our guest an opportunity to give the listeners a take-home message. Is there anything that you would like people to remember?
I'd like to have folks remember the importance of physical activity in our daily lives. So we not only do we want to stay fit, but we also need to stay hydrated.
There you go. It is amazing, as the amazing consistency of message that we hear from all of our sports medicine people is almost the same thing without the hydration caveat, which you have so eloquently tacked on there. So thank you for that. And so for those of you who have been listening and you've been wondering where the T-shirt question is, here's Justin.
What percent of individuals were deemed moderately dehydrated in the winter?
So there you go. Be the first one to send us an email at huffinespodcast@hlkn.tamu.edu with the answer to that question, and you'll win one of our nifty podcast T-shirts. You better hurry up, too. They're running low. You want to make sure that you have one of the first editions. So thank you again, Mindy, for being with us today.
Thank you, Tim.
You're welcome. Our listeners should know that this has been quite an endeavor to arrange schedules, especially with the technology fun that we've had this morning. It really has been, we've had a lot of laughs here as we've done this. So thank you so much, Mindy, for being with us. And like I said, I think we'll talk later about the role of gender in sport.
I think it would be a great topic, Tim.
Okay. And for all those of you that are listening out there, again, thank you for taking the time to spend with us. Tune in next week or download next week to find out who we talk to next week. It's always a fun conversation. In the meantime, we hope you stay active and stay healthy.
Thanks for listening to the Huffines Institute Weekly Sports Medicine Podcast. This podcast was produced by Justin Dobson and made possible by generous support from the Omar Smith family and the Sydney and J.L. Huffines family. This podcast is published under a Creative Commons 3.0 license. That means you can't sell it or change it, but feel free to give it to everyone you know and to talk and blog about us. And in case you were wondering, our openings and closing are provided by johnmilesproductions.com, providing voiceovers internationally. Music was provided by Dave Zeltner. Find him on the web at davidzeltner.com. And just so you know, we love hearing from you. If you have questions or comments, please send them to huffinespodcast@hlkn.tamu.edu. From all of us at the Huffines Institute, we hope you have an active and healthy week.